This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's been another difficult week for local government. Birmingham City Council announced it needs to make up to 600 redundancies to help balance its books, and Middlesbrough Council decided to apply to the government for £15 million of emergency funding to avoid effective bankruptcy. Also this week, new figures have been released showing just how much debt some local authorities hold. And it's a lot. From 2000 to 2018, two councils declared themselves unable to balance their books. In the last 5 years, 11 councils have followed suit. Given the responsibilities of local government, that feels serious for many of us. So just how bad are things? And is the problem local or systemic? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First of all, let's start by identifying which councils have been in trouble recently with Paul Lynch, who works for the BBC's Shared Data Unit. Paul Lynch, can we begin by going through what's happened at some of those councils that have had to effectively declare themselves bankrupt?
You may have heard this term, effective bankruptcy, used by a bunch of news outlets to describe when a council has issued what's called a Section 114 notice. It's not really bankruptcy, it's just become a shorthand to describe this legislation that was part of the Local Government Act back in 1988. This is when a council can't meet its in-year spending commitments. So since 2021, we've had six councils issue these so-called Section 114 notices. So they're Croydon, Slough, Thurrock, Woking and Nottingham. The one thing that's really important to stress, it's very easy to point at one particular thing bringing a council down, as it were, when almost always it's a series of factors from their general investment strategy, if you like, to whether they have an ageing population and probably most crucially, how much reserves they have in the bank.
Let's start with the biggest, which is obviously Birmingham.
So Birmingham Council is a really unusual one because they have had this historic equal pay claim that last year they found they owed an extra £760 million to employees that weren't paid the same amount as mainly male counterparts. A council, crucially, unlike a business, has to balance its books in year. And that equal pay revelation last year meant the council would be around £80 million or so short this financial year, the one we're currently in this year. And it's also why Croydon, here's another one, that's issued three separate Section 114 notices since 2020, because in successive years, it has repeatedly been unable to meet its in-year commitments. We can almost categorise these councils in the way they've gone to effective bankruptcy. When you look at Croydon, alongside, say, Woking, maybe Thurrock and Slough, you can certainly point to some, shall we say, aggressive spending financed by loans as being a major factor in their collapse. Woking effectively repositioned itself as a property developer in the late 2010s. It spent around £600 million on two skyscrapers in the centre of town, and then £400 million on a failed housing development that simply took too long to make money. Incidentally, most of those loans were from the Public Works Loan Board, and this is part of the Treasury. So, of course, the loans they're receiving were also public money.
It's fair to say that we've had a large number of extra councils issuing these 114 notices than we've ever seen before. I mean, that's the overall pattern.
Yeah, that's right. So oddly, I was the chief reporter of the Northampton Chronicle and Echo when that council went bust in 2018. It'd be fair to say the world's media was shining a light on Northamptonshire County Council the day they ratified an emergency budget. It was declared the worst run council in Europe, if you remember. It was unthinkable that a local authority could go bust. Its misdemeanours now would probably seem rather tame in comparison to some of the spending we've seen. And effectively what happened was the Conservative administration there historically had the lowest council tax in the UK, and it's fair to say then became sort of politically wedded to that claim. So incredibly rare, really, up until 2021.
There's those councils that have declared themselves in trouble. There are hundreds of other councils that haven't. Should we assume that actually everything is pretty much okay with them?
I think it's fair to say not. And this is where things get really tricky, because we are obviously in the run-up to an election, and this is likely to be a huge political football. So a number of councils have publicly declared they are on the brink of or at risk of issuing a Section 114 notice soon. So we can sort of confidently say Somerset, Southampton, Hastings, Medway, Havering, North Northamptonshire, Leicester, Warwick, Dudley, Stoke, Cheshire East, Bradford and Middlesbrough. That's a few that have publicly declared that they're on the brink. When we looked at council deficits back in August last year, so this is the amount councils are expected to be short if they're not to make any cuts in 2 years' time. Leicester and Bradford, both Labour-run councils, they both said they were running dangerously low on reserves. But then there's like to be a whole host of authorities who are remaining quiet about their troubles, perhaps for political reasons. The Local Government Association recently did a survey that found one in five of all of its members would need to issue a Section 114 by the end of 2025. Another survey back in 2022 found that one in six councils risked effective bankruptcy within that year. So although not all of those went bust, a bit of a back of a fag packet maths there would suggest about 60 or so councils at that time thought they might. So there's probably really a hidden issue of councils struggling but not necessarily declaring that publicly.
Crudely, do we have any idea of the size of the debt mountain that councils face?
Well, councils do submit their debt returns to the Office of Local Government. And our research, we found that if you combine councils in the UK, they've got a combined debt of £97.8 billion as of the last snapshot. If you add police and crime commissioners and joint authorities, that rises to £122 billion. But what we should say is actually there are huge differences between the councils. There's about 30 or so councils that have no debt whatsoever. And then Woking, as we've previously mentioned, has around £2 billion worth of debt. The important thing, I think, here is to what we call normalise that data, or obviously judge it by a sense of scale. And obviously Birmingham, obviously the biggest council in Europe, has the most amount of debt. But actually, as soon as you start normalising that, actually they appear around 40th on the table, and Woking is way out ahead. So if you look at debt per person in Woking, it's worth about £18,000 per person. The average is about £1,400 across the country. So quite an outlier there.
Paul Lynch. So now we have an idea of which councils have problems and roughly why. But how did they get into their financial difficulties? What pressures are facing local government at the moment, and what's the outlook for the future? Aileen Murphy is Specialist Advisor to the Levelling Up Housing and Communities Select Committee and former National Audit Office Director. Tony Travers is Visiting Professor at the LSE's Department of Government, and Kate Ogden is Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Aileen Murphy, can you take us through what it is that councils have to provide?
There are a number of services statutorily based, generally speaking, that councils have to provide. The most important of these are adult social care for vulnerable adults in the community and the provision of residential care for people who aren't self-funding. Children's social care, including the safeguarding functions and looking after children in care. They have education functions as well, though many secondary schools and some primaries too are academies. There's also waste, the collection of waste and recycling. And last but not least, planning and housing, which includes homelessness services. So a great range of services.
Right. OK.
One I did forget there was library services. That is a statutory function as well.
Where do local councils actually get their money from?
So there are several sources for monies that councils get in. First, and the one that most people will be aware of, is council tax, property tax levied on domestic homes in particular areas. There are also business rates, which are a national rate levied on the bricks and mortar businesses, which is set with a national rate, but then collected and spent locally, though sums retained by the department. Then we have locally generated income, that's fees and charges for services, and income that comes from commercial ventures, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. And last but not least, central government grants of various types.
And roughly how do the proportions break down between those funding sources?
The majority of it will come from central government grants of various types, although proportionately council tax is getting more important over time.
Now, Kate Ogden, let's talk about the pressures as they are currently. Why are councils in general struggling to balance the books?
So during the austerity years from 2010 onwards, really, we saw really big cuts to the funding that local councils had, which really continued until maybe 2019. And after that, we've seen a slight picking up. Councils have actually seen an increase in the funding that is available to them in the last few years. A big problem is that some of the costs and the demands that councils face seem to have been increasing faster than the funding. So one part of this is general inflation. Costs for delivering lots of things have gone up. Also, the increase in the national living wage will have affected what councils have to pay to some of their lowest paid staff, and particularly social care staff. And then there are also particular demand pressures, which we don't fully understand yet, but are coming through things like home-to-school transport for children with special educational needs. We've seen rising costs of children's social care, a lot of which is to do with sort of very specialised placements for children with really particular needs. Aileen mentioned that they do homelessness services, and we've seen rising costs for temporary accommodation, so housing people who are homeless.
Tony Travers, you and I have been talking about these things for so many years. And the one thing I suppose I wonder over those years is whether or not when national government finds itself in some kind of degree of difficulty, local government isn't a kind of easier place to cut than sections of national spending.
There's no question that it's far easier for central government to pass on cuts to local government than to face doing them themselves. Now, it's slightly more complicated than that, but just to, you know, with the original idea, it certainly happened in the government that's been in power since 2010, so the coalition and then the Conservative governments that have followed. And of course, that has the added advantage that a significant part of local government will be controlled increasingly by your political opponents. So that means that you're forcing people other than your party to justify making cuts at the local level and then to say their services are good. So it has both a sort of logic in terms of taking the pressure off yourself to having, for example, to cut the NHS or cut the state pension. And it also then passes on some of the difficulty of doing it to your political opponents.
I'm also wondering whether there isn't a greater ability on the part of local government, or greater willingness on the part of local government, to make the cuts than there would be, let's say, in the education service or in the National Health Service.
Well, absolutely, because councils are legally bound, and with most of their spending, they're required to have as much income for the year as they're spending in the year. And if the chief finance officer thinks there won't be enough income, then they have to declare a status called Section 114 notices, issue a Section 114 notice, try to get things back into balance. So that discipline means that whatever level of spending councils are required to deliver by national government, they will. Local government is required to balance its books every year. Big Secret is actually quite good at managing public money. And in the end, The government knows that, and I've certainly talked to Treasury officials in the past who have said something along these lines, that local government is better at managing spending down than many big national government services.
So let's talk about them, exactly how they do manage those cuts, or rather how they have managed those cuts. What do they do?
They'll reduce their spending, but in a number of ways, and they're quite effective at making sure it doesn't all look like cuts. So let's just take two. They sound slightly trivial examples, but if you look around you, you'll see things going on out there like quite significantly changed refuse collection arrangements. So more recycling, a good thing. But actually, more recycling has often got tangled up with fewer refuse collections. And, you know, you can see the arrival of the wildflower meadow. Good for bees. You know, it sounds trivial, but it's good for wildlife. But it does mean the parks need maintaining less. Now, I use these as what sound like trivial examples to show how councils are relatively good at turning a bad situation into a better one. Having said that, there are some very severe and serious consequences. So, for example, an older person needs care during the night, to get out of bed. Care during those hours out of working hours, do they have a social worker go around to their home, or does the council say, no, we're going to provide you with enough facilities and enough equipment at home to look after yourself? And that kind of trade can be very painful, and there's a lot of that going on out there.
Yeah, well, let's be clear about this. What you mean is, instead of having somebody get you out of bed and take you to the loo, you're provided with incontinence pads to mop up what it is you'll do during the night. That,
I'm afraid, is a real-life example, and it is a very good, i.e. bad, example of the trade-offs that councils have to make, which real people then have to live with.
Aileen, the example that Tony gave just there is one example of an additional pressure on local government across the board, which is an ageing population and so on. But Kate also mentioned earlier special educational needs, which is a kind of concrete example where demand has increased. Can you talk a bit about why demand has increased, to give a kind of indication of how these things pile up for a local authority?
I think there are a number of different things that are impacting on special educational needs as a demand. I think the first one, and most obviously, is the education, health and care plan, that once you have that, your child is statutorily entitled to a certain level of service. And there are more and more of those being issued because as a society, we're getting better and better at diagnosing things like neurodivergence and putting in things to help. And also over time, many more children have survived to teenage and adulthood who wouldn't have in years gone by. I mean, when I was a child, I don't think I knew anyone who had Downs who survived into their 20s. And that's quite common now. So there's increasing demand from that. The other thing is the government expanded the care plans to cover people not to the age of 18, but to 25. Now, some additional money was provided for councils to do that, but they've all complained that it's not enough. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is a big upward swing in the cost of home to school transport. I think in the last financial year, it had gone up by something like 23%. So if you have an EACP, your child is then entitled to the cost of transport to school being covered by the authority. So that budget is under quite considerable pressure.
Kate, let's turn this round slightly, which is, yes, we have increased numbers of councils issuing Section 114. But of course, we've got loads and loads of councils, and that means loads and loads of councils aren't. So are the ones which are in real difficulty simply outliers, simply people who've managed it badly? Or can it also be the case that some councils really have additional burdens that other councils just don't have to deal with?
Very much the latter. So if we had a sensible local government funding system and councils were funded according to their needs, then you'd only expect to see kind of concentrated problems where there was mismanagement. In fact, we have a broken system which doesn't allocate funding to places according to their needs or their costs. So that means some areas will have a lot less funding to deliver what they need to, given the neediness of their population and the costs they face.
So we're talking about a combination of factors which are, yes, there is some mismanagement, but there are some really big endemic problems with areas of big need. OK, now, just before we move on to the business of what running out of money actually means, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes If Trump Gets Re-Elected, What Does the World Do?, the big problem with Airbnb and how assisted dying has worked out abroad. Now back to local government finance. Tony, I think a lot of listeners would have been surprised by some of the things which you said earlier in the programme, that so many councils were involved in activities that most of us would have assumed that councils wouldn't get involved with, such as property investments or green energy schemes and so on. Why are councils these days involved in such things?
Well, it has something to do with the pressure their budgets have been put under since 2010. So in that period, as Kate said, in the last two or three years, they've had much more generous settlements. But over the whole period since 2010, spending is now, day-to-day spending, is substantially lower in real terms than it was back in 2010, even though demands have increased. And some councils have tried to turn investments, so they've tried to make investments in shopping centres, solar energy schemes, building in the town centre, whatever it is, to get those investments where they can borrow to fund those to produce a revenue stream, so income on a day-to-day basis that could then help underpin their squeezed day-to-day spending. Now, most councils that have done things along these lines have done it responsibly. A small number have done it very irresponsibly, and that's why we've ended up in cases like Thurrock and Woking with the councils in the very difficult situations that they now find themselves in.
Are we to understand that actually a lot of councils have made pretty good investments and have supplemented their income rather successfully by making them?
Well, overwhelmingly, councils borrow money to make investments for rational reasons, to build schools, to repave the town centre, to fill in potholes, or at least to resurface the road so there aren't so many potholes. They do things like that. They may well borrow to do these things for assets that have more than 1 year's lifespan. And that's perfectly sensible. So a lot of their borrowing is sensible. Some of them will have made investments that have produced revenue returns. The ones that have gone to the bad have generally done it at epic scale, and begging huge questions about both the auditors in those cases and the lack of oversight, and also about councillors' and officers' judgment. So it's a tiny number that have got into terrible trouble, but the overwhelming majority invest wisely.
And Tony, just before we move on, can you tell me whether broadly or not the system of funding and levels of expenditure have been the same throughout the UK, i.e. in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales and England?
Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland's local government systems, which are separately run by the governments of those three nations, were in the early years of what's now called austerity rather more generously treated. But latterly, if anything, and certainly in Scotland, local government's been put under rather greater pressure, so more like England. And at the moment, there's a freeze on council tax going up in Scotland, which has put local government in a significantly difficult position. So it was a bit easier for local government in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland initially after 2010. But subsequently, it's not a million miles away from what we're discussing for England.
Kate Ogden, I'm going to reintroduce a phrase we haven't heard for some time, which is levelling up. How does the settlements for local government, which the government has announced in recent years and which it has been talking about more recently, sit with the objective of getting money and investment into particular areas that have been deprived of them in the past?
Not at all, really. So I've mentioned the funding system's quite broken. The way that funding's allocated year on year is quite ad hoc. We've seen since 2010, the big cuts that took place in the first half of the 2010s disproportionately fell on councils in deprived areas. That's because they were more reliant to start with on grant funding from government and they raised less in council tax. So when grants were cut, they were kind of hit hardest. In the last couple of settlements, we had seen a slight shift, so slightly more funding go towards more deprived areas or slightly bigger increases towards them. That wasn't the case in the most recent settlement. So across the board, we saw fairly similar increases in the amount that councils will have to spend next year. And overall, that means funding is a lot less targeted towards deprivation and less targeted towards need than it used to be.
Right, Tony. So looking at the past and projecting into the future, when we talk about how that pain is shared and how much of that pain local government shares, would you say that what you're looking at adds up to an even more difficult situation for local government in a year's time, 2 years' time?
on the current figures, it certainly does. And we're in the sort of slightly strange world now of, you know, looking into the future at existing spending plans and trying to second guess this chancellor and future chancellors as to how they're going to divvy up public money into the future. But I want to just make one point. You know, we're now living in a country in the United Kingdom where the economy barely grows at all. We've moved from trend growth, that is average growth per year of about 2.5%, down to 1%, and now nearer to 0%. Nobody knows quite what to do about that. We also know that taxation can't go up because we're now seen as overtaxed, or overwhelmingly, the average person is seen as overtaxed, and the government can't borrow much more money. If you add all those three things together, it means that effectively public spending as a total can't grow. Now, politicians find it very hard to deny the NHS money. The state pension is triple locked and goes up in real terms. There are other areas like defence, which are clearly going to need more money. So they've got these ring-fenced areas. And once you ring-fence them and the state can't grow, everything else has to be cut. And local government is inside everything else. So it's a mathematical certainty at the moment that local government will be squeezed again from 25, 26 through to 27, 28 and beyond.
Kate, you raised the question earlier of how much more some things impact upon some councils than others. Is part of the answer here that we should change the formula whereby the money is distributed to particular councils? In other words, have a much greater notion about where need actually exists?
The government committed to do this in 2017. Something that was called the Review of Relative Needs and Resources, which is kind of self-explanatory. And they were meant to be reassessing the needs of different areas and also reassessing how much they could raise for themselves. That didn't happen. It got pushed back. They haven't reassessed what different areas need since 2013. Each year, patterns of need get further and further away from what they were. The funding gets further and further misaligned to what it might be in a world where funding followed need. And so the changes that are needed get consequently bigger each year that it's put off.
Tony and Aileen, final question to you along the same kind of lines, really, which is, if there were any easy set of reforms which could be introduced, or set of changes, or maybe even difficult set of reforms and changes which could be introduced in local government finance, what would you go for first? Aileen?
I think I would certainly go along with what Kate says about the relative needs formula. I think that certainly needs doing. And I think the other thing is that for central government departments to be realistic, if you have a 10-year plan for the NHS with finance attached, you need a 10-year plan for social care with finance attached. It's realistic because the two services are completely intertwined.
Tony?
No question that, you know, successive governments' failure to reform social care financing and funding is a real problem, and that definitely needs a tackling. I mean, I think removing the constraints on the caps on council tax would mean there'd be a genuine local debate about how high council tax should go, and also, you know, how much people are willing to pay more council tax in order to protect local services. And at the moment, that just doesn't happen. The government effectively, through capping council tax, stops that. I think in the end, and this is an inevitability rather than something that would be very popular, I think councils are going to end up charging more for services. I think we're going to see more charging for services, more means testing, I suspect, over time. I think we're going to have to start being more creative to look at ways of raising money for services people want, but where the tax burden can no longer go up anymore.
Tony Travers there with Aileen Murphy and Kate Ogden. My thanks to them and to Paul Lynch. And my conclusion from all that, well, no one seems optimistic about local government facing anything but more cuts, even though there may be some ways to make them less painful. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye.
I'm John Ronson, and I'm back with Season 2 of Things Fell Apart, my show for BBC Radio 4 that unearths the origin stories of the culture wars. This time around, the stories are all about the battlefronts that engulfed us during lockdown. The stories twist and turn until each one ends with the explosion of a new, far-reaching culture war.
If you tell me that my nephew had superhuman strength, If you tell me that he didn't feel any pain, well, he's dead now.
That's Things Fell Apart, Season 2. Listen on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.